Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 262, The Battle of Hlobane, Cowardice, Confusion, and the Reckoning at Devil's Pass. By mid-March 1879, Fetchwa Kampande had made another attempt to open talks with Chelmsford, sending his Ndunas to negotiate for peace, but the British had no appetite for compromise. On the 22nd of March, two emissaries arrived at Middeldrift, a central crossing between Natal and Zululand, but Chelmsford had already laid out rules that any Zulu representative should communicate directly with him. Captain Frank Cherry, who was the commanding officer of the 3rd Regiment, Natal Native Contingent, was stationed at Middeldrift. His job was primarily defensive, guarding that specific crossing point against the potential Zulu counter-invasion of Natal. Alongside him, F.B. Finney, the border agent for the Lower Tugela. Finney was a crucial figure because he was one of the few British officials who was fluent in Zulu and understood the nuances of Zulu diplomacy. The two messengers used their Christian names, Johannes and Klaas. They brought a message from King Cetshwayo that essentially said, "What have I done? I want peace. Let the fighting stop." They were frigidly received and sent back with a reminder about the terms of the ultimatum before war began. The British were also fully aware that Cetshwayo had called a general muster of his army at Ondini and believed the two messengers were actually spies. A day later, on the 23rd of March, two other messengers arrived in Ishowe, but Lieutenant Colonel Pearson ordered them to be clapped into irons. They were spies, he said, and could not be accorded the traditional sanctity they enjoyed as royal emissaries. Cetshwayo by now had been joined by his main army, and he was pondering where to send them. Unfortunately for Colonel Evelyn Wood, the Zulu king decided they should attack his column in the north. After the largely inconsequential but shocking massacre at the Ntombi River we covered last episode, Colonel Wood was in a bit of a bind. He'd lost over 70 men on the 12th of March. Still, he had something positive to report to Lord Chelmsford. Cetshwayo's eldest brother, Prince Hamu, had decided to switch sides and support the British. Many of the men of his Amabutu had fought the British at St. Luana, and Wood promptly recruited these very same men into his column as irregular troops, despite the fact that their spears had been so recently washed by imperial British blood. It's hard to explain how the military works to most people, but battles are not carried out with the hot-headedness of hate. When a soldier wants to swap sides, usually they are debriefed, given a quick training update, checked to ensure they're not lunatics, and then given their new uniforms and weapons and signed on. They are most useful when it comes to intelligence gathering. Chelmsford was over the moon about Hamu's move and believed what he called the important event would spread doubt and distrust in Zululand. Partly to alleviate the pressure on Pearson in Ishowe, and partly because he hoped to capitalize on Hamu's arrival, Chelmsford gave Wood carte blanche to make an attack on the Zulu. "If you're in any position to make forward movements about the 27th of March, so that the news may reach the neighborhood of Ishowe about the 29th, I think it may have a good effect." A relief column was on its way from Natal and would soon cross the Lower Tugela on its way to Ishowe. Perhaps some kind of victory to the north, where Wood was operating, would draw the Zulu Amabutu away. Wood was nothing if not a quick operator. A few days after receiving the order, on the 28th of March, he launched a two-pronged attack on the Abakulusi stronghold of Hlobane Mountain. It was risky. Not only did he have no idea how many Zulu warriors faced him, he also had no idea what lay in store on the summit. He didn't know, for example, there wasn't actually a summit. There were two plateaus. The eastern plateau was the highest, nearly 4 kilometers long and 1.5 kilometers wide, of gently undulating grassland, while below it, 220 meters above the plain, lay a smaller western plateau at 1.5 kilometers long and just under 1 kilometer wide. Hlobane is less a single peak than a broken sandstone massif, rising abruptly from the rolling grasslands of northern KwaZulu-Natal, west of the Batshe and Ngomi, or Blood River systems. Its summit forms a long, irregular plateau, strewn with boulders and cut by shallow gullies, while its edges fall away in steep scarps and rock-strewn slopes that in places become almost precipitous. To 19th-century soldiers approaching from the surrounding plains, the mountain appeared at first manageable, but this impression was deceptive. Once on its flanks, Movement became slow, fragmented, and exposed. The ground broken into ledges and shelves and narrow passes rather than open slopes. Wood's two columns were going to attack via the eastern and western approaches, which consisted of rising grassland broken by rocky outcrops, allowing mounted men to advance in loose formation, but then forcing them to dismount as the gradient steepened. Higher up, the grass thinned and gave way to patches of low scrub, scattered thorn trees, and exposed rock, providing intermittent cover, but also concealing defenders in folds of ground invisible from below. It was also pockmarked by caves. The northern and eastern faces are markedly harsher, steeper, more dissected and cut by dongas and ravines, making ascent difficult and retreat even more hazardous, especially under pressure. The vegetation hardly made it easier. Open sourveld grasslands on the lower slopes, cropped seasonally by game and cattle, but still dense enough in summer to reach knee or even waist height. Interspersed were clumps of bushveld species like acacia thorn, wild syringa, and scrubby protea-like growth in poorer soils, with taller trees clustered along drainage grounds where moisture lingered. For Zulu defenders familiar with the ground, this landscape offered decisive advantages. The broken slopes allowed warriors to move unseen between folds of terrain, while the boulders and scrub provided natural firing positions for those armed with muskets. Conversely, the same features disrupted European drill and formation, breaking Wood's force into smaller groups as they climbed, each unit momentarily isolated by the folds of the mountain. What from a distance looked like a single defensive position was in reality a series of micro-terrains, each capable of holding or delaying an attacking force. The result was a landscape that was neither dense bush nor open plain, but a patchwork of grass, rock, and scrub, favoring irregular warfare over formal maneuver. Wood was entering a bit of a can of worms situation. Colonel Redverse Buller was to ascend the eastern end with 400 horsemen and Wood's irregulars, including the St. Luana Abakulusi vets, while Lieutenant Colonel Cecil Russell led his 200-strong Imperial Mounted Infantry and a second battalion of Wood's irregulars as far as they could up the western slopes. "Without incurring severe loss," ordered Wood. So in a nutshell, Buller's men were the hammer, Russell's the anvil. Evelyn Wood sent a private message to Chelmsford on the eve, warning that he wasn't very sanguine about victory, but at least he could keep some of the Zulu from heading south to Ishowe. He had guessed correctly, because that's precisely what Cetshwayo was planning, to send the bulk of his army north to fight Wood and not south to the Tugela. Abakulusi, who remained out in the field, had asked for help after Hamu's defection, and their king had heard their call. The 20,000-strong army had set off from Ondini on the 24th of March, heading straight for Hlebane, led by Chief Mnyamana of the Buthelezi. However, the tactical command was still in the hands of Chief Nchingwayo, and his deputy was extremely aggressive Chief Zebebu. The day that this major force was going to arrive in Hlebane was the 28th of March. It was going to take them 4 days to trot the 100 kilometers from Ondini to the mountain, which lies near the modern town of Vryheid. Wood, by the way, had received intelligence reports that this powerful army was on its way, but he had been told they had left on the 26th, not the 24th, so he believed there was still time to take Hlebane before the main army arrived. The colonial mounted force was quite a mix, the Edendale troop and Natal native force led by Lieutenant Colonel Russell, Commandant Friedrich Scharrenbrücker and his 110 men from the Kaffrarian Rifles, Eastern Capers, now on horses, Baker's horse with 150 men, and two units of Transvaal commandos, Commandant Peter Raaf's Transvaal Rangers and Colonel Frederick Weatherly's Border Horse. Weatherly deserves a special mention for two reasons. One, his colourful life, and two, his abject cowardice. First, his life. One of those larger-than-life characters who appeared on the fringes of the Victorian period, a Canadian born in 1820, who served in a crack Austrian regiment, then gained a commission in the British Army and fought with the Dragoons during the Indian Mutiny, and he was a friend of South African Governor Sir Bartle Frere. But he was also a prodigious name-dropper and married to what was called a flashy woman, Fanny Dubley, who accompanied Weatherly wherever he went on campaign. She carried a revolver, wore men's trousers, and lashed out at anyone she disliked with her riding crop. When the couple arrived in South Africa with their two sons in 1877, Weatherly bought land near Lydenburg. Shortly thereafter, his wife left him for a confidence trickster. He was now a single father. Based in the Transvaal, Weatherly raised the border horse at the start of the Anglo-Zulu War and led 50 men, including his two sons, one just 14 years old. Weatherly was part of Buller's section, heading towards the almost impassable eastern slopes of Hlobane on the morning of the 27th of March. Buller left Kambula at 8 a.m. on that day. He had further to go than Russell's section, and then he stopped well south of Hlobane and lit numerous fires on the evening of the 27th. This was a ruse. He wanted the Zulu lookouts on the mountain to think he was heading past in order to strike deeper into Zululand. After sunset, he quietly moved his men to within 8 kilometers southeast of Hlobane. Somehow, Weatherly and his men became lost during the move. They were going to arrive late, with tragic consequences. Meanwhile, Russell's force marched out of Kambula at about 1 p.m. on the 27th and covered 25 kilometers to within 8 kilometers west of Hlobane. Later, Wood and his staff joined Russell at the bivouac at dusk. Wood spoke with Piet Eys there, who said he wanted to discuss the attack. Perhaps he had a premonition.
"Piet warned me," Wood reported later. "Said, Colonel, if you are killed, I will take care of your children, and if I am killed, you will do the same for me."
Wood agreed. At 3 on the morning of the 28th, Buller and his men, sans Weatherly's border horse, who was still AWOL, set off from their bivouac and reached the narrow path up the east side of Hlobane. The thick morning mist hid their movement. They dismounted and led their horses up the steep ascent. They had almost reached the summit when Abakulusi's sentries spotted them and opened fire, killing two of the officers, Lieutenant George Williams and Baron von Steitenkron, as well as a trooper. Von Steitenkron was another of those 19th century soldiers of fortune. A mercenary, he had fought in the Austro-Hungarian War of 1866, serving as adjutant to Field Marshal Benedek. Live by the sword, die by the sword. Wood's irregulars, including Zulu warriors who'd fought the British at Isandlwana, moved forward and swarmed up the east side of Hlobane, and soon the eastern plateau was in Buller's hands. But then the mist burned off and Buller's jaw dropped.
"I was horrified at the size of the place," he wrote later, "and its unpracticability."
Yes, that is a word. There were only 3 ways off the top. One, the eastern path they had taken, the second, a path down the northeast side into Itjenka Neck, and a third, which was later to be dubbed Devil's Path, down to the lower plateau. On either side of this third pass was a ravine over 120 feet high, insecure footholds, narrow ledges onto the lower plateau, then almost another impassable path down 250 meters to the plain below. Buller quickly secured the eastern plateau and seized as many of the Abakulusi cattle as he could, while the irregulars darted about and his mounted men fired into the caves and crevices. Colonel Russell's vanguard and irregular troops, meanwhile, had made it up the lower plateau on the western side, and when he made it to this point, Lieutenant Cecil Williams, who commanded Hamu's men, said they had seen Buller's force on the higher plateau. Russell sent troops to collect as many cattle as they could, but contrary to his orders, he made no serious attempt to get his men up on the western end of the higher plateau. He thought it impossible to get his cavalry up this extremely dangerous path, but it still should not have stopped him sending dismounted soldiers and the irregular troops to assist Buller. Behind both these sections came Colonel Wood with a tiny escort of 8 mounted infantrymen and 7 Zulus on foot. The Zulus were part of the force brought by Prince Mtonga Kampandi, who was Cetshwayo's half-brother and rival who was fighting for the British. Wood had been riding in silence towards Hlobane, the plateau beginning to take on a sinister edge. Beside him was Captain the Honourable Ronald George Elidor Campbell, the second son of the Earl of Cawdor. While the name Cawdor carries the dark Shakespearean weight of Macbeth, Campbell's own lineage was no less storied. Campbell carried the high-born blood of the Plantagenets through the great House of Howard, making him a distant kinsman to the House of York.
It was a striking juxtaposition, a scion of medieval English royalty, a man whose ancestors had shaped the Wars of the Roses, now riding across the rugged South African veld towards a cold destiny near a Zulu cave. Two younger officers, Lieutenant Henry Lysons and interpreter Llewellyn Lloyd, were chatting away gaily. One asked Wood if he was worried they wouldn't reach the top. Wood said, oh no, they were going to reach it. Then of what were you thinking? Wood replied gloomily, which one of you will be writing to my wife tonight? Or about which of you young men I shall be writing to your parents or wife? Up rode Weatherly and his border horse, heading in the wrong direction, away from the mountain. They'd got lost, he said. Well, head towards the sound of the firing, commanded Wood, pointing to the northeast side of Hlebani, where shots were heard. As Weatherly's border horse and Wood's escort approached, Zulu snipers began shooting and Weatherly's men dived to cover. Wood was indignant. He rode past them with his mounted escort and irregulars on foot. Soon the slope was too steep. They dismounted. Wood led his horse, while the others left their mounts in a disused stone kraal. About 50 meters from the summit, they began to take well-directed fire, accurate shooting, while the bulk of the border horse tried to pick off the snipers from behind. Just then, a single Zulu warrior stepped out from behind a boulder less than 20 meters away and shot Translator Lloyd in the back.
I am hit.
Badly? Asked Wood.
Yes, very badly. My back is broken.
Campbell picked Lloyd up and carried him down to the stone kraal where the horses waited. Wood kept climbing up, but then his horse was shot and killed, knocking him down. He scrambled back down to the kraal and tried to give Lloyd a shot of brandy, but he was already dead. Wood ordered Campbell and Weatherly to clear the cave of snipers. Campbell leapt up, but Weatherly pretended he didn't hear. Campbell was joined by 6 other troopers. They charged towards the cave, where he was promptly shot in the head at point-blank range and killed. The snipers were eventually cleared by the British. It is now that an extraordinary moment took place. In the midst of this battle, surrounded and under fire, Wood decided to bury the 2 officers immediately, rather than wait. Campbell had been like a son, he was to say later. He pointed to a spot a little way down the slope, and the irregular troops began to dig 2 graves with their spears. Wood sent bugler Walkinshaw up the slope to his dead horse to retrieve the saddlebag containing the prayer book. This commander was preparing to risk the life of his favourite bugler, an indication of just how shattered he was. A form of post-traumatic stress had seized the British officer's mind. Wood had lost his sense of priority. Several 100 Zulu warriors could be seen approaching along Itienka Neck. Instead of turning to deal with this critical danger, Wood saw one of the bodies could not be laid flat, so he ordered the graves to be lengthened. Still the Zulu approached, and the dazed Wood began to read an abridged burial service from his prayer book. Buller's men on the high ground watched all of this dumbstruck and opened fire on their approaching Zulu. Weatherly requested permission to retreat, and Wood in shock nodded. Up on the eastern plateau ground, Buller had seized 2,000 cattle and had rushed to the edge of Hlebani. They were under increasingly hot fire. Then he ordered Lieutenant Barton to head down the hill and bury Williams, the officer killed earlier, as you heard, little knowing he'd issued Barton with a death sentence. Because shortly after Barton and his detachment left, Buller spotted 20,000 Zulu warriors on the plain, marching in 5 great columns. Chief Metlika Zulu said later, "The English were up the mountain and did not see us. We came around the mountain." Ngomama Nkosi, Ukandem Pemvu, and the Mkriyu had detached from the main force and were running towards the east side of Hlebani, where Buller and his men were attempting to descend. Buller sent an urgent message for Barton to return by the right of the mountain, the north, but the message was garbled, because Barton was going down the Hlebani with his back to it. He thought he should turn to his right. He was now heading straight into the jaws of death, and the Ides of March were going to play Weatherly a cruel trick. Barton, you see, bumped into Weatherly's men on the way down and told them he was on his way to the safe side. Naturally, Weatherly joined him. The 70 horsemen charged around the corner of the mountain, galloping west,
when they were confronted by the chilling sight of a huge Zulu column sprinting towards them in full battle mode. The Zulu were moving faster than the men on horseback, along the slope and around the boulders and the rocks. The border horse turned under heavy crossfire towards Itienka neck, but it was no good. Some riders tumbled to their deaths. Others were assegaied. Many were shot. Mounted officer Sichichili of the Mkio regiment killed several of the British himself. As he approached his last victim, the man turned his carbine around and shot himself. Weatherly and his 14-year-old son were amongst the dead. 25 men of the combined Barton-Weatherly group made it over the neck, but they were chased onwards. Eventually, almost all were tracked down and killed. Barton himself was wounded, and after he fell, Sichichili spared him. "I could not let anyone else kill him," he said later. It was 10:30 a.m. Colonel Russell on the western side, meanwhile, had abandoned his men at Lubani, including his own deputy, Lieutenant Brown. Of course, at this point, Buller had no idea that one of his backup officers had done a bunk. Buller had to make a quick decision, fight to the death on the summit or descend Devil's Pass to the lower plateau. He, of course, believed Russell was still down there, and if his men could make it there, they would be reinforced. Hundreds of Abakulusi pursued Buller and his men down to this lower plateau, where he then discovered, to his shock, Russell's men weren't there. All he had left was the unfortunate Lieutenant Brown and a handful of men to mind the top of the pass, and it was these few who held back the Abakulusi as Buller's men descended down the terrifyingly steep and precipitous pass. But they were overtaken by Zulu warriors. 17 of Buller's men died before reaching the plain, including Piet Ace. The Boer had reached safety moments earlier, but then looked back and saw his son was in trouble. He rushed to help and was assegaied. At the base of the mountain, Buller took stock. His men were still in deep trouble because half were now on foot, their horses dead or lost. They all fought a fighting retreat, Buller personally rescuing 3 men who were about to be killed by warriors, for which he was to be awarded the Victoria Cross. Eventually, Buller's disheveled men reached Zungwini Mountain, where Russell awaited. Buller rounded on him furiously. Russell tried to defend himself, saying he had no orders to wait.
"Perhaps not," growled Buller, "but you had no orders to abandon me either."
Wood had reached Zungwini earlier and waited until 7 p.m. when Buller had finally appeared. They all retired to Kambula camp in safety. Later, word reached the survivors that more British may be on the field. Buller, who had not slept for 2 days, rode off into the dark, half hoping that Barton may still be alive. A little while later, he returned with 7 survivors of the border horse, but not Barton. The British lost 15 officers and 220 men at the Battle of Lubani, and half their horses. Remarkably, and for the first time in Zulu British war history, Trooper Ernest Grandier of Weatherley's border horse had been captured alive by the Zulu in the aftermath of the battle and taken to Undini. He was released unharmed by Zulu King Cetshwayo and reached British lines near Kambula on the 16th of April. Wood was to keep his promise to Piet Ace, recommending that 36,000 acres of government land be kept aside for Ace's 9 children. This was eventually granted by the Colonial Office, but only after pressure from Governor Bartle Frere and Queen Victoria. Strange tales indeed. By now, the tide was turning for the British, and the Zulu kingdom was on very shaky ground. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. Head off to desmondlatham.blog, where there are updates about various episodes. You can sign up for my little newsletter there. Until next, Salagatli.